Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namasami. So, these lovely pictures we have of all these Buddha images. Quite a gallery. I think we have another 50 or so photos like that. And they're all the famous statues that you see in all the Buddhist books. And the Buddha image speaks from the posture and the hand gestures. So the one we have here is from the Tibetan tradition, and the one hand is touching the ground, the one behind me, the tanka. So you have the hand touching, and then you have the bowl. I think that's a medicine bowl. We don't use that particular image in Theravada, but the calling the earth to witness, that posture, that's a very famous one. So you see that in the second picture here. The Buddha in the earth witness posture. Now, which is the story of just before the Buddha gained enlightenment. He was got into a bit of doubt, it seems. And Mara came to him and said, "So who do you think you are anyway? Who do you think you have a lot of nerve to think you can get enlightened?" And touched the earth, he said, "The earth is my witness that I've done all the work necessary. I've developed all the paramitas, I've developed all the virtues, that I am bound for enlightenment, I am destined for enlightenment, or enlightenment is my inheritance." And then, of course, the great stories of the goddess from the sea, the earth goddess, arises out of the sea, and she has long tresses, and rings out her hair, wrung out her hair, and there's a flood carried Mara away, and then the Buddha proceeded to enlightenment. Neat story. And then this one is a preaching Buddha, so you have like the Buddha that sometimes you see is First Noble Truth, Second Noble Truth, Third Noble Truth. It's one of the ways to gesture like that. This is, I think, a Bhai Mudra. This is fearlessness. This is Samadhi, seated Buddha, right here, the second one, and so on. So there's a whole, that's fearlessness, I think, above Marsha there. That's Samadhi. So the iconography of Buddhism speaks through the mudras, through the hand gestures, and through posture. And the idea of a Buddha image is that, well, why I think of this when I came into the shrine, it's so beautiful to come into this very rough barn, but really nicely configured space, where the shrine is beautifully set up, and there are beautiful flowers, and my seat's nicely arranged, and this water, and there's the Buddha image, and all of that, of course, it's very good for the mind, isn't it? You come in, and I look at the Buddha, I say, "Ah, there he is, my old friend," or whatever. But there's this sort of external idea of the Buddha as historical being, or whatever, as teacher, but there's also the idea of awakened. So the way one often uses a Buddha image or a stupa is to, when you look at it, stop the mind and remember awakening. In other words, awakening. This is the way it is now. And rather than just look at it as aesthetically pleasing. So the Western way of looking at it is maybe through the artistic delighted it, whether you like the nose or you dislike the nose or you like this or that, which is okay. We all have a sense of aesthetics. But deeper than that, as an icon in that old traditional religious sense, it's something to remind us to be awake. Be awake. So you can imagine countries like Indonesia or Thailand or Burma. You have stupas. In Burma, they have stupas almost on every hill. And it's supposed to remind that country to awaken, but it's in a deep torpor of awful government and so on. But religious imagery or Buddhist imagery at least has that quality to just stop. Stop, awaken, remember, be here now. And then again, just to remind you of the other things on the shrine, so you have a Buddha image, you have the flowers. The flowers usually represent, in the Theravada tradition, in Thai tradition, sila, which is moral purity. And so the beauty of a flower in full bloom is like the beauty of a person who lives a good ethical life. The beauty of ethics, rather than ethics is something which is, or morality, which is somehow fearful and heavy and dark. It's those images we have of all kind of puritanical, joyless morality. But I think the images of Buddhism is that there's a great beauty in human character when we live a truly compassionate and generous life and we refrain from harm to other beings. And then, of course, the incense. The incense represents the focus of the mind. So sometimes just the point of light is like the mind which is very focused on an object of meditation. Sometimes we say like the fragrance of the incense is like the fragrance of a mind which is collected. And you can see the difference, like when your mind is really scattered, it smells like a rotten old raccoon. But when when it's composed and when it's settled, it has a kind of beautiful tone about it. So that's how we sometimes use the incense as symbology. The candles represent light, the light which dispels darkness, or panna. So these three, sila, samadhi, panna. Sila is ethics or morality. Samadhi is the collectedness of the mind, focus of the mind which is collected, concentration, which is samadhi, and then panya, which is wisdom, discernment or understanding or insight. And that's, you hear that again and again and again. That's a traditional way of talking about Buddhism. Sila, samadhi, panya, morality, concentration, wisdom. Which requires no real doctrinal belief. Doesn't really require any kind of thing that you have to take on that you don't believe in. And then the reason we bow, we do a lot of bowing, keep our backs flexible until we're 90 in Buddhism, but more than that, it's like using body language, using body language for grace and for in a beautiful way, and in a ways which remind us of what we're doing. So bowing is a very humble act, and I know I found it terribly uncomfortable in Thailand when I first bowed, or then when I was a monk, when someone bowed at me, and I felt so self-conscious. And I think all Westerners would feel that, but the bowing isn't towards someone as much as something about one's own heart. Certainly, one bows to one's teacher because it's a nice thing to do and so on. But more than that, it's like humbling the heart or opening the heart in the sense of being available for teaching. So when we come into a shrine, we undertake these very simple rituals. They're not necessary, but they can be a very beautiful part of developing a culture of spirituality, a culture of aspiration, rather than just some kind of meditation technique. technique. Meditation techniques are fine, but I've been fortunate that I've imbibed my first drinking in of Buddhism was in the Buddhist culture. So I saw how many aspects there were to Buddhism which were more than just the psychology and the meditation, which was what I tended to be interested in. So when you come into a shrine, you don't need to bow and all that, but just if you want to use it as a vehicle, just try to do that. Or if you have a shrine in your room, say, just create a space where when you go to it, you remember calm, you remember peace, you remember enlightenment, you remember all those qualities which are so lovely in this tradition, because we forget. You know, we get very scattered and so on. So it's a very nice reminder. And then you can see that sets a framework, doesn't it? Or sets a foundation for when you do your sitting practice. So if you look at what we're doing here when we come into the shrine room, it's not just being at the monastery. It's trying to introduce the laity, those who aren't resident in the community, ways of bringing more constant qualities of the spiritual practice into one's life. So you could see if you have a few Buddha images in your home, or they don't have to be Buddhist, but they are images or objects which remind you of those good qualities, then that's going to be very, very helpful, because when you turn to that corner of the room, it might be, you know, an Ikebana display, or might be whatever you like. It doesn't have to be Buddhist per se, but that we as human beings, we have this capacity to remember wholesomeness, to remember goodness, but we too often forget. We too often get caught up in all the urgencies of life and complexities. So developing an environment in your own home, just like in the monastery, we found it quite important to set up a shrine room. That's the first thing we did before we moved. I don't know when, at one point I arrived, and the first thing, set up the shrine. Move the furniture, because it was quite interesting. We moved in, it was full of clothing, and full of old furniture, new furniture, whatever furniture, and then first thing, up, set up the shrine, do that, do the chanting, set up the priority. Kitchen was second. and so if in the way you set up like the way we set this up, then we wanted a space which was separate from the house, so we have two shrine rooms, and it's getting cold in the morning, so we move back into the house in the mornings, because we're practical, we're not, you know, that religious. But you can see how a dedicated space really helps the mind. You come in and all of a sudden you're silent, don't you? You come in quietly, you come in more mindfully. You're kind of more careful of where you move around between people or between the cushions. So what is developed is a kind of beauty. And this is one of the ways that I know Ajahn Chah liked to teach. He would use the word beauty a lot. So if I was quite sloppy and like in Thailand, you don't push things around with your feet. Like if one of these chanting books was say over here, and then I would push it over there with my foot, that would be quite offensive in Thailand. And Ajahn Chah would say, "You pig, Veer Dhamma." He wouldn't say that. He'd say, "My sue." He says, "It's not beautiful." And that was a really nice way of teaching, and it wasn't kind of whipping me into some Asian format and cloning me as a Thai monk, but saying, "Oh, that's not very beautiful." And some of the things were cultural, but I saw the overall tone of it was grace and mindfulness and a lot of beauty and movement. And those are things which aren't so much a technique as a whole way of evolving lifestyles which are in line with mindfulness, grace, things like that. And so the shrine then, the shrine represents a kind of necessary foundation for liberation. Right? It's like just like paying homage to the Buddha is a necessary foundation, not as doctrine, or not as dogma, say. Like what happens, of course, in religious language between different traditions sometimes is people just reinforce their point of view. So one faction of one religion reinforces a certain idea, and they just reinforce it and reinforce it and reinforce it. And it just becomes a kind of encrusted position in your consciousness, which isn't really liberating. It's just simply divisive and separating and another view and opinion. So when we pay homage to the Buddha, we're not just trying to reinforce some kind of in-group idea. Buddha said this, and therefore you have to believe it, because that wouldn't liberate us. It would make us a cult. Okay, a Buddhist cult where we would all keep reinforcing our views of the universe, but we wouldn't really understand those. They would just be reinforced. So paying homage to the Buddha is on one hand, a recognition that there is enlightenment, and this particular being, we would say, was enlightened. But so beyond just the particular person, there also there's the fact that the human consciousness has a possibility, a deep possibility, and that we as human beings can realize that or come to some approach to that. And that's a very optimistic statement of the human situation. Very optimistic that there are deep possibilities of peace and compassion in human consciousness. It's very, very optimistic. So and then the Buddha himself, if you want to take on a tradition, then you say, well, okay, what did he say? What might have he said? And so you read and you hear teachers and you begin to have faith, not just by taking this up as a belief system, but you have faith to say, well, why would he say that? And what does that mean about my own life? You have a kind of faith which begins to question your own views and opinions about the world, your own positions, or whatever it is. You have a faith to listen, because you have some sense of tribe, some sense of trust that, okay, this is this teacher who is in his tradition, or these books which are in this tradition, have some validity which I need to investigate. And I've always found that what I try to do is if there's something which goes against my worldview of what I think is whatever, and there's a real opposition to it from a teacher or from a book, I say, well, I better be careful with this one. I'm not sure, but I'm not going to take my opinion before I really, really check this out. And usually, in the past, I've always been wrong anyway. So, now that's the kind of testing faith, because why I say this is sometimes in Western culture, people, they'll pick up a teaching, and if it grates against them, sometimes the grating against, yeah, okay, that is, maybe that's sexist, or that's misogynist, or whatever, you can see that there are things like that. But there are other things that great against us, which we don't want to look at. So we dismiss it. We say, well, I don't agree with that. But so to take a teaching on board and to really make it question your own existence, question your own life, is the way of contemplation and reflection. So things like, I was just thinking of this language that we have in the West now, like follow your bliss. You know, what does that mean? To me, it would be a recipe for disaster if I followed some of the things that I thought were blissful. So you want to take LSD? Right? So follow your bliss can be a kind of happy statement which, you know, can be interpreted in a skillful way or unskillful way. I could follow my bliss, but the way I was following my bliss means that you would be hurt. in others would be hurt, in the environment would be hurt. And that would be utterly against what the Buddha was really trying to point to. So sometimes in popular culture you get these sort of phrases that don't have really, when you test them, you say, well, what does that really mean? You know, what are we really talking about there? And yet people can toss them out in a kind of perfunctory way and think they're actually saying something wise. And they can sound very good. They're nice little catch lines. But the human mind is very complicated. You know, our emotional makeup and our the way that the body works and all that. I don't think there are any simple catchphrases to understand yourself. But to come to some deep understanding of yourself, to have some faith that you can do something, and this is what the law of karma is pointing to, is that you and I can, when we act, when we think, when we speak, when we act physically, that there are results. And it's very important. That if I think in certain trains of thought, if I speak in certain ways, if I act in certain ways, there are going to be consequences. And those consequences can be ones which lay a foundation for freedom and peace and enlightenment, or there can be consequences which lead to my suffering and your suffering. And that is a part of a Buddhist faith, which isn't so much a belief in a particular dogmatic position about ultimate reality or rebirth or things like that, but actually it's about the mechanisms of consciousness. It's just the very way we operate where we're. Now it's a very obvious thing that when you do something there are consequences, but if you really take it on board, if you really have faith in that, then you begin to question why the way you're thinking, or the way you're acting, or the way you're speaking. And it's that questioning of your own intentions, of your own activity, of your own inner world, which begins to edify you. Right? That's just where you get educated, or you have insight, isn't it? And now that insight is based on a suggestion from your teachers that there are consequences. There is karma, and there is a karmic result. So you have a teaching on action, a teaching on action and result. You pick up that teaching with faith, not blind belief, but with the faith to test it out and try it. Huh? And then you try it out and you say, yeah, if I think cruelly, or if I think jealously about something, the result is not happy. I'm not happy. I get alienated or something. So, a sense of homage to a teaching, homage to the Buddha, a sense of picking it up, working with it, leads to confidence. So faith moves to confidence. And that confidence is grounded in your own realization. It's beyond belief, because you know, if I want to hurt someone, and I refrain from hurting them with the wrong speech, then the result, if I do it skillfully, the result's very good. And if I want to hurt someone and I get lost in my own heedlessness and I hurt them, then the result is painful. It's alienating, it's separating. And that insight is mine. And it's genuine, and it's authentic, and it leads to liberation. And yet it comes from, it comes from a certain amount of my own conclusions in life, but also things that teachers have suggested and others have suggested. So faith can lead to confidence. And confidence is something that people quite often get confused with, because the contents of their consciousness sometimes can be quite overwhelming. So what we always emphasize is in Buddhism is that if you make the causes for peace, then peace will be the result. But it might not be right now. So if I'm feeling very scattered, and I decide I'm just going to collect my attention, that decision Right? That decision doesn't lead to an immediate calming of the mind, but that decision to act, and then the action itself, if it's done through skill, is the cause. That's the cause. I lay the cause down. And then I keep laying that cause down, the cause down, and then eventually the mind settles into peace. Make the cause right, you get the right result. Now, connecting the cause and the result also leads to confidence, doesn't it? You know, the more you see that, the more you see, I lay this cause down, and say, ah, it's peaceful. And sometimes we forget that. Like, sometimes you'll be meditating, and your mind will be just askew with all kinds of stuff, right? And, wow, that was a terrible meditation. And the next day, the next hour, whatever, you're sitting with your eyes very peaceful. And, well, I wish I could have that all the time. You don't realize that the reason you've got that peace now is because you sat through the restlessness the hour before. You laid the causes down, right? And, oh, well, how do I get that peace back? And then I had that last hour. No, just keep laying the causes down, laying the causes down. And understanding this connection then, in your own life, who you are, what your cultural conditioning is, your childhood conditioning is, what your gender conditioning is, and so many other things, and what work you need to do is part of the craft of the contemplative life. It's a very individual craft. Four of us went to go see the Renoir exhibit yesterday at the National Gallery. Very, very lovely exhibit of landscapes. And just the descriptions of this man's craft, not his creativity, but also the craft of him using the way he used oil paints and the way his mind could see things and so on and so forth. And you'd go up close to one of these pictures and it'd just be these big blobs of paint. And you go back and say, wow, how do you do that? Huh? And you can see throughout his life he was constantly developing his craft. Well, in the same way, but I think in a more, in a way which I think is more rewarding, although I don't know where he was at, the craft of the heart is that same, you take the material of your life, your condition from childhood, your gender conditioning and all the other factors which have led to this moment, right? And then you try to craft the causes, you keep making the causes for peace. So just like those big splotches of paint, you know, right now, like if you look close, they don't look like a seascape, and then you step back, and it is a seascape. So sometimes the little splotches of work that you do on your own heart might not seem like much, you know, just kind of settling your mind, big deal. But it is a big deal because each of those little splotches then creates a seascape. So that kind of attitude, I think, the spiritual life as craft, rather than spiritual life as breakthrough or attainment. Now, breakthroughs and attainments, certainly, you know, we all have various kinds of epiphanies and those lovely little bits every now and then. But they're very much every now and then. But the kind of daily stuff, which might lay the foundation for profound experiences or insights, they are very mundane. They're very mundane. They're very ordinary. Just the language that you introduce to, like when you sit down. Like, what kind of language are you using? Are you using any language? Are you using any kind of thought which is skillful, any intention? Or is it just hoping the mind will be peaceful? Just kind of waiting for peace to arrive. Right? Well, you can be a bit more proactive than that. you can make suggestions, can't you? So if I make a suggestion, just settle in your body. Just settle in your body. Now if I do that from an understanding I have an understanding of that language because I've used it and I've done it, right? So then I have a language which I've developed, which is part of my craft. And the languages come from experimenting. So, you know, like maybe when I started meditation, I tried focusing too hard. Focusing real, real hard. It was too kind of fierce. And then I maybe developed, I just let the body become conscious, settle into the body. Well, that works, that's better. Part of the craft, right? And then as you get good at your craft, then that language is very personal. And teachers will give you their kind of personal takes on it. But the language is very significant. So it's like, I guess it's like the brushstrokes of a painter who's painted all their life. You know, each brushstroke is significant because it's filled with that much training, that much of the craft. Or someone who makes a lovely meal. You know, they know how to cut vegetables efficiently and put spices together, etc., etc. But that doesn't come right away. It comes from the craft. And cultivating the heart and bringing awareness to the body and bringing attention to moods of mind, these are things which we often don't have time for because we're so busy planning and organizing and running hither and thither and so on, or getting distracted. So what the teachings on mindfulness are suggesting is that you get to know yourself, you get to know your conscious experience in ways which are a bit different than anatomical descriptions of your body. It's just like get to know your body as an energy form. Get to know heat. Get to know pain. And what do you mean by get to know? Well, just learn to be aware of it. Just learn to be aware of like pressure, warmth, coldness, pain, discomfort, all these kinds of things which are part of the body. Now, getting to know the body in the body or as the body, rather than the body being a vehicle for work or a vehicle for sexual enjoyment or something that you feel self-conscious about or something that you know, body as a kind of a thing that you have a concept around, and then body as an energy experience. So the teaching on mindfulness is like, really, know the body in the body. And what happens when you do that? When you take time? When you're in a sitting, you just, part of your craft, part of the development of your craft, of awareness, is to know the body as a body. Not as a concept, not as a demand to be something, but just as it is, right? Then the body begins to become alive in a way which then in the future becomes a way where you can understand your life through the body, through the energy body. Now that's one thing that I think if people live in thought a lot and are always thinking and organizing and looking at visual imagery on screens or listening to audio bits and pieces, right? The body gets very much ignored. It's just something we use. We drag around and, you know, you bathe it every now and then, you feed it and then you put it to sleep. But actually, allowing the body to kind of speak for itself, to become conscious, is very important for the health of the body, but also is a very profound information system to know the body in the body. And if I've only been thinking, and then I begin to try to be aware of the body. Like, if you've been thinking a lot and you sit down, notice how long it might take for the body to actually become conscious. What happens, your mind just goes to thought all the time, goes to thought. So to actually to settle your attention into the body, you've got to keep making this part of your craft. And your mind wants to go off into the thinking realms. How can I make it just settle into the body? Settle into the body, settle in. And it takes a while for the body to become conscious. And then you notice all kinds of things. You notice tensions, you notice energy, you begin to understand your own experience of life in the bodily form, because you are incarnate in the body, better understand it. Whereas I think the way in Western culture is like you stretch the body and you make it fit and you make sure it doesn't have enough cholesterol or has enough, too much, whatever you have to do with cholesterol. and so it's always just kind of manipulating this thing called body, but actually what does it mean to be living in a body? And what can it teach you? And it can teach a lot. It has a lot of information. It has a lot of understanding. And that's not intellectual. It's at the energy level. Then the teaching also suggests that you that you look at your conscious experience and see that this very basic polarity of like and dislike, of attraction and repulsion. This is one of the basic polarities that exist in consciousness. You're attracted to something, or you're repelled by something. You're drawn to something beautiful, sweet, pleasant, comfortable, delightful, interesting, resonant. And then you're repelled by that which is painful, ugly, loud, nasty, blah, 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 blah. And this basic polarity is what keeps the mind very restless. It's like kind of magnetic forces. You're pulled by the positive, as it were, and you're repelled by the negative. You're pulled by the comfortable, you're repelled by pain. You're pulled by the beautiful, you're repelled by the ugly. And as long as the mind is constant, doesn't understand that, as long as the mind is always reacting to the pleasant and pain, it will always be restless. Because the pleasant and the unpleasant are just a part of our conscious experience. And as long as one is reacting and not knowing that, you're not knowing that, the mind will never be peaceful. It'll always just be in a reactive mode. This isn't denying pleasantness or saying there's anything wrong with the pleasant. It's just saying this is part of consciousness. Consciousness is this way. So if you have a mind state which comes up and it's unpleasant, and you haven't understood unpleasant, and you just grab that mind state and try to get rid of it, then you haven't understood the mind. But if you have a mind state which is unpleasant, and you know, oh, this is just unpleasant, and you know how to bear with it and watch it, then it will cease into the peace of the mind, the silence of the mind. If you have a memory, let's say if you said something at work which was very unkind to someone, last week, and then you get the memory of that, and you're a conscientious person, you're not some awful creep or whatever, but you're really conscientious, you want to practice, you have a lot of goodness in your heart. When that memory comes up into your mind, that will be unpleasant. You won't like that. You won't like that. Now if you can understand, oh, this is just unpleasant, it will change, it will cease. And you bear witness to that, and you feel the pain of that in your heart, or the embarrassment of it, or when you feel embarrassed by something, you don't want it in your mind, you want to get rid of it, you want to annihilate it. But when you can let that become fully conscious, no, this is just unpleasant, bear witness to it, and you have the perseverance, as you bear witness to it, something in you becomes more conscientious, you're going to be more careful, but also that unpleasantness ceases. The memory ceases and you come to a peaceful state of mind. But if you, and this is a basic part of consciousness, that what we'll call Vedana. It's pull, push and pull, push and pull, all the time going on. Look at you look at consciousness. Just look at, like, just lay down, like, quite, you know, if you sit on a cushion, you think you're going to lay down, you'll be comfortable. Give it 15 minutes, you'll be uncomfortable. Right? And you know there's no pain there, actually. You're all right. It's not unless you have severe physical problems. You know, and just kind of feel the unpleasantness, and just be with unpleasantness, but don't move on. Don't be rigid. But actually, just learn. Oh, this is just discomfort. This is just pressure. So you're practicing with Vedana. You're practicing with this pleasant and unpleasant aspect, or this push and pull, this attraction and repulsion. So you'd say, like, if you go home and you're all stiff and tired or whatever, you lay down and try not to fall asleep. Or if you do fall asleep, set your alarm clock, then wake up again, then lay down and just look at, like, okay, it feels really pleasant. And then how long before it changes to unpleasant? And then what do you do with the unpleasant once it moves? But you're allowed to move if you're over 60. You can't. but these little experiments, they give you the kind of insight around pleasant and unpleasant. You see, like Ajahn Kusala now, he's got a lot of unpleasant Vedana. So what he just distracts, which is good, you know. So distraction is fine sometimes, because it's just so painful and so negative, he uses distraction. So it's not wrong, but that we understand that in our consciousness. So in Buddhist contemplation, what we're doing is we're trying to look at our conscious experience at a deeper level than just my personality and my problems. We're trying to see the underlying fundamental building blocks of a conscious life, of being conscious, of being in a sense body. So Buddhism looks at our life as both social beings, right? So there's the moral life, there's the life of responsibility, and this is, asks us to look at consciousness itself before we create a self around it. So with the body, as a responsible person, I try to take care of the body because that's what the body, you know, it needs nutrition, it needs exercise, so that's taking care of the body. But vanity is not understanding the body, it's a self-obsession with the body. But actually, what's the body really like? What is it like? Okay, so body, then Vedana. Vedana is this push and pull. It's always going on. And that is the basic structure that Paticca-samuppada is based on, or dependent origination. Because around that, from Vedana, you get tanha, you get craving. And from craving, you get attachment. From attachment, you get becoming. Becoming, you get birth, all this and that, so on. So, very important to understand. Vedana, tanha, pasalina, tanha, contact, feeling, craving, right? And so if you do specific actions, so when you sit, say, you sit down and get yourself a comfortable posture, and the first sense of discomfort, okay, that's definitely not pleasant. It's almost be unpleasant. Oh, so this is Vedana. Well, this is what unpleasantness feels like. So you're not originally, I shouldn't move, or, get a little more comfortable. But you're actually just looking at what unpleasantness, what is that? And then you're contemplating, wanting this to go away. That's where aversion comes in. Hatred, aversion, tanha, vibhava tanha, all those. And you're just seeing that actually the knowing of that, it's okay, it's just unpleasant. And then you move when you have to, you don't hurt yourself. No, you know, you don't have to hurt yourself. Or if you get a really, let's say you go out and do walking meditation, and you get tired from walking meditation, and you know, you don't want to sit down on the belt, and you say, oh, that feels really comfortable. Okay, the comfort is pleasant. It just, you know, comfort is really nice. How long does it stay comfortable? How long is it? 5 minutes? Lucky. 10 minutes, if you got really good concentration, a long time. Yeah, but then when comfort changes to discomfort, you see the movement. Now, do you move with the movement? Or do you stay as the witness? Do you move? Do you become that? Do you attach to it? Do you get restless? Do you get rigid? Oh, how much more time is there? Or do you say, oh, this is discomfort? Then you can move. You can certainly move, but to see that basic structure, and that basic structure is in all sense experience, Vedana. So it moves from a polarity of negativity, extreme negativity, middle negativity, mild negativity, sort of neutrality, then positivity. Then, you know, there's a whole range of things. Sometimes it's neutral. If you see something, like if you, let's say you're out in the forest and you smell a rotting raccoon. You know, the smell of flesh rotting is really awful, right? But just stand there. Okay, that, you know, the first hit it, whoa. But just stand there and see how long can you, what do you have to do to sustain the negativity? Don't you have to react to it? If you just really let that smell be there, I mean, it's there for a reason. It's there to protect us from eating rotten food, so it's biological. But if you just let that smell be there as a witness, you'll see it'll go to neutrality. It'll still smell rotten. But your aversion to it is something that comes because it's unpleasant. Oh, I don't like anything. Right? So you can kind of play around with that in little bits of your mind. And then if you understand that, then you'll understand it in all things. So you have the body, as you know, the body, in we say the body as the body. And you have Vedana, and then you have the moods of the mind. And the moods of the mind are the, like if I'm in a excited mood, I will be excited about something, some event I'm going to do or some thing I'm going to create or whatever, right? But excitement itself is a more fundamental type. It's a fundamental type of consciousness, isn't it? Or it's a mood. It's a mood of the mind. If I feel alienated by someone, I feel afraid of them, right? There'll be the object of my fear, but also that sense of being of fear, fearful or shy, will be something more basic. It'll just be a mood of the mind. If I feel inspired by something, I'd be inspired by the object. The object of the person inspires me. You see the Dalai Lama, it's wonderful, wonderful, you practice, practice, practice. But the very nature of like inspiration, that's more fundamental than the person that I'm inspired by. It's a mood of the mind, yeah? If I feel totally like, what? How do you practice? I don't understand this practice at all, right? The things which have confused me will create the mood, but deeper than the things is the mood, the confusion, right? So the Buddha is suggesting learn to understand the moods of the mind, not simply always be caught up in the particulars of those moods. So I get excited about A, I get excited about B, I get excited about C, but what is excitement? And what is the usefulness of it? And where does it lead me to suffering? And disappointment, what's that? Rather than what I'm disappointed at. So this is the moods of the mind. Now, to look at a mood of the mind, you have to depersonalize it. If I am angry at someone, this is quite, we try to look at anger, don't we? If I feel frightened by someone, I try to look at fear. So that's what we call the looking at the mind as stream of consciousness. We also have a social aspect. So if I'm angry at someone and they have misbehaved, then maybe I have to address that too. Their misbehavior. That's fine. It's a social part. So these three things, the body in the body, vedana, feeling in feeling, and citta, or mind, or mood of the mind. Are ways of kind of what we call like frameworks or references of understanding the phenomena of consciousness. And what do we want to understand in that? What causes suffering and what's the end of suffering? So rather than, you know, like analyze things in a very personal sense, which is okay too, we have that too, you can analyze things in your own personal family history and so on, but the kind of Buddhist approach to it is to see in this stream of consciousness, these are the types of frameworks the Buddha suggests we look at, right? And then within that, understand, well, where does your suffering arise? How does suffering arise? So you have a mood, and they're all connected. Because when I'm in a despondent mood, my energy body feels down. And if it's down, the vedana is unpleasant, right? And I want to do something about it. If I am inspired, the mood of the mind influences my body. The body has a different energy field, and it's pleasant. I like that. I like inspiration. I don't like despondency. So, can I stay inspired always? Nope. Not possible, right? Sometimes you can get inspired, sure, but to sustain inspiration 24/7 is not human. Can't do it. So you begin to see, well, inspiration's neat, get it when you can, but inspiration is not a refuge. Right? So inspiration is unsatisfactory. That doesn't mean inspiration is unpleasant. It just means that inspiration will change. So when inspiration comes up, I say, oh, thank you, great. But when it changes to boredom or despondency, I say, oh yeah, that's supposed to be that. Inspiration is supposed to change because inspiration is unsatisfactory. Right? It's dukkha. And that's what people caught up and don't understand about Buddhism. They say, well, inspiration is not dukkha, it's dukkha. Good stuff. Yeah, but it's not, you can't rely on it. So what can you rely on? You can rely on that sense of awareness of change that you can rely on. You know what you can rely on. When you feel inspired, you can rely on the fact that any inspiration will change. And if you rely on that, then you tend to go towards gratitude for the pleasant and patience for the unpleasant. Right? Whereas if you don't contemplate that, you tend to hope you can permanentize inspiration or pleasantness and try to hold on to it, and then be fearful or push away anything that's unpleasant. So you tend to get into greed and aversion. Whereas with this contemplation, you tend to go to gratitude and patience. Because we'll have pleasant and unpleasant, it's just the way it is. So we're trying to look at our conscious experience in a flow of consciousness and take away the self sense, the I sense, the me making, mind making. And if you find that there is a lot of, as we say, as it said, I making, my making, me making, that manufacture of a sense of self, then that's a warning sign. The stronger it is, the bigger the delusion. When you're really, really angry, you really, really manufacture a strong sense of self and other, don't you? When you're really, really frightened, you really manufacture a strong sense of me and what I'm afraid of. And when you're cool, right, when you're not caught up, you're not manufacturing a sense of I. There's presence, there's response, you know, all of that's going on. Alright? Something to chew on?